You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Hello and welcome to TFM's Local Watering Hole. Just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and so excited to be here in the 602 Club with the one, the only, is that Catwoman?
Hello and welcome to this perfectly wonderful podcast.
That's right. And with us to dive into the one, the only Batman the movie from 1966. Penguin? What are you doing here?
You know, no. We all know that if anything, I'm the Joker, maybe the Riddler or Chief O'Hara. Because Chief O'Hara always struck me as a guy that you know, when happy hour rolled around, when his shift was over, I'm pretty sure Chief O'Hara was tying one on in Gotham City pubs every single
you
night.
You are the Riddler, John,
no,
without
just,
a doubt.
I see you at Burgess Meredith. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, the Penguin did go on to train Rocky. So, you know, we know that when he's throwing
exactly.
those punches in the movie, they're legit. So
exactly. Well, we are going to be starting our Batman series where we are going to be talking through all of the films Batman-wise that we haven't talked about yet. This is a request from John Mills. We're going to start with Batman 66. And so before we dive in, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure you subscribe so you get the show as soon as it drops. Also, of course, make sure that if you're on Apple Podcasts, give us a star rating review. We'll read those out in the show. And really, they continue to help the show grow. It's incredible, but it's still true. And you can find us on Twitter at the 602 Club. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/trackfm. We've got our listeners only discussion group, the Babel Conference, you can join. You can find us online at Trek FM. There's the contact section where you can send us an email if you would like on the website. And of course, you can find us on Instagram at 602 Club TFM. And then last but not least, want to say a huge thank you to our associate producers here through Patreon, Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, Ryan Millett, and Daniel Noah. Really appreciate these guys supporting the network and the show to make sure it keeps coming to you each and every week. And so if you like what we do here, please go over to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can be part of the team. All of those contributions make sure that these shows keep coming to you. We've got new shows in the works as well, revamping everything. And in fact, your Patreon subscription is going to be even better because there's going to be some things that you'll only be able to get through being a subscriber through Patreon. So it's more important than ever. We need your help. Again, go to patreon.com/trackfm and see how you can be part of the team. So before we got into anything about the movie, I really wondered because, you know, this is an interesting one. As to whether this was a show, you know, the Batman TV series has been in the cultural zeitgeist, obviously, since the 60s. So I am wondering if this is something that you guys grew up with at all.
The show? Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. The reruns on I'm not old enough to have seen it first run. But, yeah, that, you know, in the days of the UHF station, Latchkey Kid, Summertime. You know, everybody is at work or your older brother doesn't want to hang out with you. It's too hot to go outside. The Monkees, Batman 66, watch those, you know, waiting for something like Robotech to come on. And I hated it. I hate watched the hell out of the show growing up. The time period that I came up, I encountered it just when I was getting to be too cool for comics. But still liked pro wrestling, but had not yet encountered, you know, sort of like the rebirth of the superhero genre with Tim Burton. So it's this weird period where my brother was a comic book collector and we went all in on stuff as it got a little bit darker, and it got to stuff like, you know, Frank Miller's work, you know, with Dark Knight Returns and Year One and, you know, Death in the Family and stuff like that. So it was a really weird time to come across, you know, the 1966 show. But yeah, absolutely. This was the 1966 Batman was a staple of my summers. And I'm ashamed at this point to say how much I hate watched it. Because my brother and I would sit there and we'd just make fun of it the whole time. And then just in the course of growing up, I came to appreciate it for, you know, for what it is.
So my story is a lot different than that. And I will say I definitely wasn't around when it was originally out. and then, you know, even later than John's point. But it was something that I remember my dad showing me when I was probably five. Because there's a picture of me when I'm that young, also influenced by the Batgirl of the time wearing a similar costume. So, yeah, it's definitely something that I grew up loving, Batman and Catwoman, especially, who's still my favorite comic book character. But I wasn't as familiar with it, because I was so young. You know, I loved things about it, but I didn't know a lot about it. I just knew that my dad showed it to me and I liked certain things about it. But when I rewatched it again, as an adult, I had a newfound love for it again. So
it's so interesting because, you know, John, you and I are similar in age. And I grew up watching a lot of old television. I mean, you know, back in the day, Nick at Night was like the Donna Reed show and, you know, Dick Van Dyke and all those type of things. So we're talking really, I grew up with a lot of really old television, but I never watched this show as a kid. Like this was not something, I mean, I was aware of it being there, you know, but it wasn't something I grew up with whatsoever. And so very different from both of you. So by the time I ever saw this, I was way too old for it. And I've never really had an appreciation for it. And so I come from a completely like the opposite spectrum from you guys. And so that makes this just really fascinating to dig into, because it isn't something that, you know, I have any fondness for, really, or any nostalgia for. And so that is strange, you know. But it's interesting because, you know, John, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Superman, the movie,
mm-hmm.
either. And in many ways, I feel like this suffers from the same type of thing for me, you know, in the sense that one of the reasons I'm not a big fan of it, I don't respond as well to the take.
The campiness.
And obviously this, would put it this way, just before everybody starts yelling at me, this is obviously a much more silly, over-the-top take than Superman the movie, of course. You know, Superman the movie is much more grounded in every way, shape, and form compared to this film and the TV show. But it, in some ways, I still feel like there is some similarity to that. So it's just a strange place for me.
You know,
to be.
I don't agree with that take. We'll table the Superman thing. We've tussled about that before. But this is what I came to realize over time, and the reason. And the thing is, growing up, I had no idea this movie existed until I was an adult. Like it completely blew my mind. I came across it. However. You know, I saw it advertised somewhere. It was came on a streaming service or something. I said, wait, movie? What the hell? And watched it. Now, it completely floored me that this thing even existed. I had no knowledge of it, you know, being a thing. The great thing about this movie and about the series as a whole, and this is why I think it struggles, especially depending on the era or the age at which you encounter it. This is produced in an era which fully embraces and is comfortable with and makes fun of itself for basically how ludicrous comic books are to begin with. Now, we live in an age where it's been elevated to an art form and it's the basis of billion-dollar movie industries and stuff like that. But I always think of what Bill Watterson said, which is however mature you want to make it and how, you know, how much you put into it, it's still people in tights beating each other up. And I'm paraphrasing there, but this is very much from an era, you know, this is from that Technicolor, late 60s, you know, we haven't even encountered really the hippie culture at this moment. We haven't had Studio 54 or the gas crisis or any of these awful things that we know are in the future for the audience. This is very much still firmly in that, like, it works, I think, specifically because it's a lot like Looney Tunes, where very young kids will watch it and they'll enjoy the zany over-the-top stuff, whereas they put these little jokes in there so that the parents who are forced to watch it with their kids can get a chuckle on a level that the kids don't, and some winks and nods at the camera at everything that I think are what makes it so enjoyable.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, John. I know for sure that the makers of the movie even said that it is supposed to represent the very first age of comics, that golden age of, you know, even showing on screen when they're in the fight scene on top of the submarine, the words like thwop and sock and stuff like that, because that's the written description of the sound that they had in the actual comic books. And so it does have that other element added to it, though, of what you're saying, John, of like, it's poking fun at the era in history, making light of, you know, the difficult situation, and then also giving these jokes that would be over the head of kids possibly watching, because it does seem like it would be more kid friendly, but still have something for adults to enjoy. So I think that there's a lot of good things about it, even though it's super campy. I think they knew exactly what they were doing.
Yeah. And the thing is, it continues on from here into the show. It continues on. And the thing is, they do continue from the movie forward to drop in little moments that are actually sort of like little philosophical time bombs and commentaries on the age. Like, there's an episode, further in where the Joker becomes an esteemed abstract pop artist, like Andy Warhol type. And he makes a quote unquote painting where he puts no paint on it. And he says, he calls it something like Vision of a Bat. And it's mocking the modern art movement while at the same time making this sly joke because a bat doesn't see anything, you know, that sort of thing. So, sorry, Matt. I just, you know, that's what I'm plugging into here.
No, I think, you know, what you guys are talking about is really important. I think it took me this watch, you know, to get here, which is, you know, the tone of this, and you rightly pointed out, Christy, is very much exactly where comics were at this point.
Right.
Which is ludicrous. I mean, you know, this is the time period in which Superman has a mini version of himself pop out of his hand, you know, just things like that that are happening in comics that are just so, they're not even taking themselves seriously anymore. And so when you're pulling, you know, from the source material, this is where you're pulling from, is that you, by this point of the golden age, comics have become almost a parody of themselves. If you were to read them now, you're like, what are they doing, you know, with this medium, you know? And it's so funny because, you know, obviously comics have these different ages and, you know, there are different points in history and the characters change along with them, you know? And so all of the main characters have gone through different iterations where you're just like scratching your head thinking, what were the creators thinking? And so for this movie to come out, for the show to have been out, it definitely makes sense that we are in a place where things are much more silly. You know, it's these are silly stories. And, you know, I mean, This is where it's bat everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You've got your bat rope, you know, and your, shark repellent bat spray. And
the bat copter.
You know, which, yep. I mean, I don't know who doesn't. John, did you, you've got some now that you live in Florida.
No,
right?
I have alligator repellent. But the, the thing is, right, all of that bat naming convention and everything, that in and of itself is them having a lot of fun with it. And there is a, you know, this is not just an era of comics being ultra silly. I mean, it's ultra silly because the audience, especially at the time, isn't a bunch of people who refuse to have thrown out their comic books. It's a bunch of people who on some level are watching it for the, you know, the kids are watching it because it's kids stuff. Mm-hmm. But any adult who happens across it, TV's still pure escapism at this point. They're still not putting, you know, husband and wife
right.
in a bed on television. They're still sleeping in separate beds, you know, because you can't mm-hmm. show that at the time and everything. So this is that father knows best era. And it still manages to, what I think one of the sort of subtle brilliances of this in specific is it shows how easy it is to craft a story on film. When, not easy in the sense that there are no bad films or that people screw it up. I'm talking about the fact that they show in a very modern art sense that you can, so long as you have the basic structure in place and you have the basic rules of composition and form and dialogue and all of those things in place, you can put anything over top of it that you want to and it still works. You still have at the core of this movie, Bruce Wayne getting his heart broken because he falls in love with Catwoman in disguise. And they even take the time to spare him thinking back to the song that they dance to and the water from mm-hmm. his submarine fight looking like tears running down his cheeks and Robin, you know, with a heartfelt, gosh, this is a Robin, anything else could be compromising, you know, like, and just that sort of, they give it that melodramatic weight to it. And it just shows if you know what you're doing, you can make anything out of, you know, out of this art form, out of this, you know, this medium. I think that's the subversive brilliance of something like this.
Well, and sort of the same way how, you know, they've taken things like Anna Karenina and sort of made a movie out of a stage play.
Mm-hmm.
They've made a movie out of a comic book here. I think that you know up front, if you're an adult watching this for the first time, that you're not going in expecting a super serious, deep storyline.
mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, this is a place to, like you kind of alluding to, I think, John, they do begin to kind of poke fun at the world around them. You know, the what their experience in the 60s at the time, the politics of the time. I mean, let's face it, it's Batman and Robin seem to be the only people with brains in this whole movie, where and the whole world literally is looking to them for salvation. and in fact, you know, we can clearly see that it's not the Security Council who people should be looking to solve all the world's problems. It's Batman and Robin.
Right.
You know, and so, but you're beginning to see the mistrust that is playing into people's lives of people in power and those kind of things, and that we're going to need somebody who's basically off the grid to begin to maybe solve our problems. And so, you know, and literally, like, Batman and Robin, they're not even vigilantes right. here. They're fully endorsed they're, members
right.
of law
that,
enforcement.
I was going to jump right into that when you were talking about people outside the system. This is the only version of Batman I know of where they specifically say they're deputized officers of the law. What they do is legal. And you, like, that, mm-hmm. I think, in and of itself is a thing for the adults to sit there and sort of snicker and say, yeah, okay, sure. You basically, you're telling me that your cops have these costumes, whatever. But, you know, in terms of the cynicism about things, people, I think, undersell that the escapism that came up in the 50s and 60s was for a culture, an entire world that was deeply traumatized by World War II. And that's why so many things seem so silly and surface in something like this or in the television of the era. these people had literally seen the worst war that had ever visited Earth, and they didn't want to come home from work and have to think, you know, they wanted to watch something that was just going to make them feel okay before they went to bed, right? Everybody's still dealing with that. But you have, these deputized officers operating within that framework, but you still have the cynicism, to your point, about when they reconstitute, the council at the end, and everybody's brain has been switched. And their observation is, well, maybe this will be better for the world after all, because now the person who's the visually recognized as the representative from Germany is arguing on France's behalf, and the person from here is arguing for over there. But the first thing that they do when they are reconstituted is they immediately start arguing. Nobody says, oh my gosh, what happened? Mm-hmm. They just pick up like nothing happened, because that's just the nature of these organizations. Or when Batman calls in the beginning, have you sold any, old decommissioned submarines? And then you guys like,
yeah, I was thinking about that.
Pete
yes.
And Gwyn. Uh-huh. Batman, do you think that was a bad idea?
Yeah, they'd only had a P.O. box.
Right. And Batman's like, maybe you won't sell submarines to people without a full address next time. Like, that type of stuff.
Yeah, scolding the Pentagon.
Yeah, that is all. That's all for the parents right there. Military brass, they're all fools. You know it. That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. But no, that's an excellent point, too, because obviously before this, when comics originally started, it was all about preaching how the government wants the best for you. And now, because of the aftermath of the war and everything, it's completely changed, and it's poking fun at the government rather than saying you should do whatever you can to serve your country. It's saying, well, the people in power of our country may not always be right.
And think about the fact again. This is right on the cusp. This is right at, this is very shortly after Kennedy is assassinated, but before Vietnam becomes what it becomes. So it very much exists in that weird, like, this show can't possibly be made and released 2 years later. Like, this is the closing of the window right here for this movie and this show to even start existing, because the world's going to change big time after this.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, I was just, thinking the exact same thing, how this is a show that is a time capsule completely, and it just shows where people were as we're just about to come out of a place where people are more trusting, and this show is kind of, and specifically this movie here is where this was really the first time where the show had become, because this movie happens after the first season. And so it's the first time where the show really began to like poke at anything political like this. And you can sense the change in the thought process of just general Americans of what they think of those in power.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that has to do, like you said, John, the Kennedy assassination, that bubble has kind of popped and it never reinflates, and it just kind of goes downhill from there, which leads me to something, really interesting, which was before the series, they wanted this to be the lead in to the series. They wanted the movie to happen first and then have the show. And so I was just wondering for you guys specifically, do you think that people would have responded to this all at all as a film if they hadn't seen the show first?
Wow. No. I think that going in cold to this is a different experience than coming into it with the knowledge. And the thing is, I have no way to know for sure whether I'm right about that, because I'd seen the show before I ever saw the movie. But there are aspects of this that I think the joke is maybe a little tougher to figure out, like not figure out, but it's a little too easy to take this as, it's a little too easy to dismiss this if you're not coming at it from the right angle, I think. And so I think that this would have been, I imagine anybody encountering this before they're familiar with how ludicrous the show is. Right? Because this is a little bit more serious in some ways. I think you still have to have gotten it before you get to this point. That's my take.
Well, and I'll piggyback off that too and just say even that although they try at the beginning of the movie to give you some explanation of what you're about to see with the, you know, words on the brick wall, that you still don't quite get everything about it. And, you know, you're not as familiar with the characters, obviously. It would be completely new coming into it. But yeah, I agree with you, John. I think that you need to see the TV series before the movie. Otherwise, I think that it's introducing a lot of things all at once and that you're not also getting that tonal change.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, in the series, they do in the very first episode, I'm pretty sure. But it's one of the, if it's not the first episode, it's one of the first episodes. They do, in fact, mention that his parents were killed in crime, and that's why he does what he does. And so for this to be an introductory piece is odd because you would think you would include that because there's no character building for Bruce Wayne in here. There's none. Yeah. And, you know, he exists outside of Batman and everything, but there's no sort of like lead in to, you know, his motivations in any sense of the word. And with a movie, typically you're at least going to spend 2 or 3 minutes, you know, even if it's just lip service, at least giving some sort of background outside of he's a rich guy that lives in a big house sort of thing.
No, he's just a happy rich guy. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think it wouldn't work the right way if people hadn't had the show. And partly about your saying, John, and this is one of the things that for me, it you know, just for the movie in general, because there's no real character development whatsoever for anyone, you would have needed the show to had given you the foundation. Otherwise, there isn't anything to this that doesn't just come across as like campy fun. You know, there's no depth to it, really. There's not a lot there to it because you don't have a foundation if this were the first thing to have seen. And so the only way this could have worked then as a film or to have a film come out first is you would have had to do some of that. You would have had to have, this movie couldn't be the same movie that came out first and then you have the show. Because also, you know, if you're not familiar with the characters at all, like, you won't know who all of these villains are. But all of these villains have been introduced in the TV show, you know, and so they, again, they're taking the foundation they've already built through a season of television and then inviting you to come to the movies to see those same characters on the big screen in a bigger adventure. And that's the only way, especially specifically this script, I think works. Otherwise you have to rethink the whole script and it would have had to be more of an introduction.
I think also you need that foundation because this is, especially if you're not sort of plugged into the show already, but even if you are plugged into the show, I mean, I've been sitting here praising it and all of that stuff. This movie acts as a testament to there are certain types of entertainment that are better in shorter amounts than in longer amounts. And the thing is, it's specifically because the fun of the show was the cliffhanger. It was always that, oh, what's going to happen next week? And you knew they were going to get out of it, but it was what pit of acid are they hanging over? What shark with laser on its freaking head is going to be showing up next week and stuff like that? And this has those sorts of breakpoints where I could see in my head, I'm like, okay, right there is where the cut it would be. And they would say, will the dynamic duo find the submarine or something like that? So I think that this is very much as I enjoy it, very much a demonstration that this specific iteration of Batman is way more suited for the small screen than for the big screen. It just doesn't scale up appropriately.
So let me ask you both about that then, because I think probably my biggest criticism of this film is that it is an hour and 45 minutes, and you can so see so many places where things have been drawn out excessively, and I do mean excessively.
Yeah.
And so for you both, what would be the ideal length for this movie that would really help with what you're talking about, John?
I think you can probably take out 45 minutes.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that. 45 minutes, really?
There's a lot of focus on the periscope.
Yes.
A lot. Yeah. A lot. Mm-hmm. And the buoy. The tricky
buoy. And sometimes
buoy.
You just can't get rid of a bomb.
Yeah.
I wouldn't touch a second of that sequence. Not at all.
Too many times, John.
No. That, you know what? The thing is, that can't get rid of a bomb thing is sort of like on Family Guy when Peter falls and hits his knee. And he's sitting there holding his knee going, ah, and you chuckle, and then it keeps going and it keeps going, and you're like, okay, this isn't funny. And then suddenly,
do you chuckle at Family Guy? Is there anything funny in Family Guy?
When Peter falls and like hurts his knee and that's a great bit. It's an example of a joke where it's like you chuckle at the beginning and then it's like okay, and then it suddenly just sort of like recycles and it becomes so ludicrous that you just start laughing again
because it's gone on so
long.
Yeah,
because it's obvious that they're just screwing with you.
Yeah,
I will say that you could probably squeeze a good 10-15 minutes out of this by just shortening certain moments where they give Adam West or Lee Merriweather or somebody else an extra beat to stare at the screen. So it's like little tiny cuts you could make here and there. It does linger a little bit long when they're going in circles in the boat. It's sort of like, there's no gag. That's sort of like the bomb. That's a gag that keeps going. Them circling in the boat is like, okay, you're just padding here. This is just still going. Like, I got the point.
Yeah.
You can let go of that.
There's no reason.
Yeah. I'd say probably the ideal running time, though, is probably like 90 minutes, right? Including credits. So you got to cut, with that opening credit sequence, you cut a nice 8 minutes out of actual running time. I think that 90 minutes with like 82 minutes of story time is sort of a perfect window for it.
I think so. This movie is literally an hour 45. I think anything longer than 115 or 120 is too long. I think if you really trimmed everything down, that makes it much more manageable. And I personally believe, and you definitely disagree here, John, but you trim down some of those sequences, and I think they're funnier than if you just keep letting them run for too long. And then to me, it stops being funny and it just starts being annoying. And I'm sure that's probably part of the charm for some people, but for me, it's like, okay, I get the humor that's happening here, but now it's run on so long, I'm just kind of annoyed that it's happening instead of laughing along with it. And so to me, that's where, I think about a 115 is where you should end with this film.
But again, you add on the 5 to 10 minutes of credits on either end. We're in the same neighborhood here. But I like the bomb one is the only one that I'm willing to fight for. Right. There are plenty of, like I said, there are plenty of other things where like, yes, it's sort of like, okay, it's not really funny. It's not working. You're padding it. But the bomb one is the only one that that's the hill I will die on with this movie.
Okay.
Because
the other thing I would have cut too is the multiple times he goes back and checks the room where Kitka was and isn't anymore.
Fair.
I think it was 3 times and we're like, dude, she's not in there.
It's fair. It's fair. Although, the thing is, and people always point to the you just can't get rid of a bomb gag, they compared it to the end of The Dark Knight Rises, but I was thinking about it, you have him fall in love with somebody who isn't who they seem, and they're really part of the big criminal syndicate trying to blow up the city. I don't know. There are some similarities here with Dark Knight Rises. I'd like to talk to Mr. Nolan about the story structure here and try to figure that out. she's the real brains behind everything. Batman falls in love with her. It's pretty close. Pretty close.
Speaking of that, the plot here, I just thought, this was, this was interesting because, you know, we do have the United Underworld, so it's all Batman's greatest villains coming together to steal a dehydrator and dehydrate the Security Council so they can ransom them for money. And the question, of course, can Batman and Robin foil their plans? Join us next time on Batman. You know, it's like, but I think one of the things that also with the length of the film was that every single villain gets to enact one of their plans against Batman. And like you were saying, John, that's an entire episode of a five-part arc, basically. Whereas, you know, this movie, we put them all into one. And it almost reminds me of, and in a less successful way, the Clone Wars movie. Where you took something that wasn't necessarily meant to all go together and you put it all together as one. This kind of feels like that. And so the plot of the movie is in some ways a part of the padding that happens, because again, you're giving every single one of these villains their opportunity to try and foil Batman.
I mean, honestly, the thing is, when you make that comparison, like the Clone Wars movie is even more successful because it was literally completely disparate things that they managed to put together into a single cohesive arc. Whereas this is a cohesive arc that should have been split up into smaller arcs that happened. as much as I love it, you know, you got to come at it with eyes wide open and stuff like that.
Yeah, I have to say, rewatching this again, I thought, is this when the like Americanized sand art took off? Because I feel like this was an ad for sand art, you know, because they have all the colorful sand and then you don't want to mix them together, but you kind of do.
You know, everything was going fine until the wacky admiral sneezed, you know, everything was fine until then. But I mean, even that, you know, just even that sort of like ludicrous childlike understanding of how government works or councils work or anything like that. It's like, oh, these specific people got dehydrated. It's like, well, yeah, we'll do what we can for them, but it's not like the council goes away. They weren't going to be there for the rest of the, you know, like you can replace people on a council. That's entirely possible, you know, but it's that very, very naive. Well, it's a celebration of that naive understanding of how the world works. You know, that things can be that way. I mean, this is easily the most fascinating Commissioner Gordon, the series and the movie, and the most, like, when I was growing up watching it, like, Chief O'Hara as a character is just bizarre. And the thing is, we'll come back to him because Commissioner Gordon in the Tim Burton movies and the Joel Schumacher movies devolves from this stalwart, you know, anti-mob commissioner of police, and he turns into Chief O'Hara by the time Joel Schumacher shows up. And it's this baffling, you know, collapse into, you know, these characters. And it's like, I was trying to explain to my kid who walked into the room while I was watching it about how even that, the Chief O'Hara thing, is a stereotype about, you know, the Irish flatfoot, that all Irishmen became, all the cops were Irishmen and stuff like that. That was like an old New York trope, right? Mm-hmm. And just explaining that that's what that's plugging into is, you know, the big city cop was always an Irishman. And it was like, that wasn't necessarily true, but that was a stereotype at the time. And that's the only reason that Chief O'Hara even exists. You know, faith in Begorra. I can't believe it. It's like, really? That's okay. Sure. But it's fun. It's fun.
Is that why they called it the paddy wagon?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't know for sure, but probably.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I noticed too, that I don't know why they threw this in, was a couple of times they seemed to directly be like a commercial for good values, where they're like, that's why you don't want to mess with Mother Nature, son, or like, I'd rather be blind than not be able to control myself due to drunkenness. What terrible people. You're like, what?
Hey, you know, you still got the comics code. You still got, you know, all of those rules going on out there. Sure.
So you think it's...
Although Bruce Wayne's willing to throw it all away for one night with Kit Kat. Yeah. So,
okay, now hang on a gosh darn second there, okay? You're talking about Lee Merriweather, all right? There's some understandability here going on. Yeah. All right? Bruce is very relatable.
Well, and that's one thing I wanted to say, you know, with the cast of this movie specifically, you know, Adam West's earnestness is what makes this work in any way, shape, and form, because he's never laughing at the camera. And he's so, again, he's just so earnest. And so everything comes across as that he truly believes what he's saying or is living the experience of what he's living in. I mean, even thinking of that ridiculous ride in the carriage, you know, where he's just making feel so real that Bruce Wayne is just dreaming of Kitka and their time together. And he sells it because he's not making a joke out of it. And I think, you know, it is impressive that he can do that so well, because if he is in any way kind of winking at the camera, because Burt Ward's Robin kind of, I think, feels like he winks at the camera every once in a while, basically with his like, well, Batman, that's why we shouldn't do, you know, but Adam West is, he's the total straight man. Like, he is totally sold out to this. And if he's not doing that, this completely would never have worked.
In a sense, it's a template for what Christopher Reeve taps into with the 1978 Superman. But the key difference there is Donner had that same earnestness about the character, whereas Adam West is sort of this anchor that lets this. I think that you're absolutely right to point it out. I think that they knew what they had. But I think that over time, what's unfortunate is Adam West didn't get the recognition for exactly what you're talking about, that he was the glue. This never works without him, period, full stop. Without Adam West, this is something that even kids would completely tune out of back in the day. His performance is exactly what you're saying. And he deserves so much more credit than he got through the years. And he became sort of as comic fans grew up and then we hit that Frank Miller phase, everybody looked down their nose at Adam West to the point where he, you know, to flash forward to, the Tim Burton Batman. I remember his interview, I think it was in Rolling Stone, where they said, you know, how do you feel about the movie? And he said, I felt I still could have played him. I should have been Batman. He's like, I am Batman. And to a lot of people, he always would be. And I believe they offered him Commissioner Gordon for the movie. And he said, no, I'm playing Batman or I'm playing nobody. And of course, you know, Warner's is like, you're out of your gosh darn mind. That's not going to happen. But how interesting would it have been to have him pass the torch in that way? To have been on screen. And, you know, when we get to that, we can talk about that and everything. But, like, that would have been so fascinating to have Adam West in there to give it that air of, I mean, it's an ultimate cheat, because you immediately, the older audience immediately gives credence and credibility to, the new Batman, because there's an on-screen passing of the torch between the actors. This Batman doesn't exist without him. Easy. Yeah.
And it does absolutely suck that he then gets treated like it was somehow his fault that this Batman was campy, when it's like, yeah, he was just the actor and he did a good job. He did a great job. So, yeah, I'm with you both on, you know, his performance being excellent. And I love that he plays it the way that he does and doesn't break character or ever come across goofy. You know, it's like, it's actually kind of funnier in his scenes when he is, you know, having some goofy moments, because he's playing it so seriously.
Well, I mean, it almost feels like he's the Roger Moore of,
yeah,
Batman,
there you go,
right? Like, because excellent. Roger, yeah, Moore in the Bond movies is playing it very earnestly in this, and he's never making fun of himself or the character or any of the situations that he's in. And so I think Adam West is able to do that same thing. And like you said, it allows everybody else to run around with their, like, chickens with their heads cut off in this role. And I mean, specifically, when you throw all of those villains together, just being outrageous and ridiculous, and I feel like almost trying to one-up each other in the ridiculousness of their performance, you have to have him there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know... Wow. And the only thing I can say about the rest of the cast is it really bothers me that Cesar Romero still has his mustache under all that makeup.
Yes.
It just looks so weird.
Wait. Who said the Joker can't have a mustache?
I mean,
it's makeup, right?
No one. I'm just saying it bothers me.
It looks weird.
So I'm not saying he can't. It seems kind of
gross. Seems weird to cover it up if you're going to have a mustache and a weird mouth.
But see, a mustache is a natural frown. You can't have that on a Joker. Joker's always smiling. So you got to cover up the mustache. And on
you
top
can't
of that,
make it part
it
of
gives
it.
Him.
But he doesn't cover it up. It's still there. That's what I'm saying.
It's painted white. You can't really see it. It's okay. It works fine. But it's, maybe it's just the fact that people in Batman and Superman movies should never grow mustaches because they're always a problem to try to work
true.
Around.
It,
who knows?
It's always a problem.
Right?
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Justice League.
We need a special edition where Joss Whedon comes in and digitally erases Cesar Romero's mustache.
Paints out the mustache. Oh, Batman, the Joss Whedon version. Oh,
there you go. There you go. Yeah.
But, you know, you both did mention Lee Merriweather, and as the Catwoman expert here, I have to say that she was amazing as well. Mm-hmm. I think that the two of, you know, she and Adam West playing their characters so straight and serious in parts really made their romance the most serious part of this movie. Mm-hmm. And I still really enjoy it. And, you know, I think, too, that you can start to tell that even though she knows something's up with him, she hasn't quite connected yet that Bruce Wayne is Batman. But even though she's technically supposed to be using him as a means to an end, she's kind of fallen for him, too.
Yeah. No, absolutely. The chemistry between West and Merriweather is good enough that I wish there was another movie they could have been in, like some other rom-com that they could have been in, because I think that mm-hmm. they have a real on-screen chemistry that is legitimate. And it's a shame that it's only found here, so far as I know. I mean, if there's another movie that they were in together, I'd love to see it. But so far as I know, this is all that I'm going to get. And it makes the movie all the better, you know, to your point. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And she made a great Catwoman.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, she is. Yeah, Lee Merriweather. I love what Anne Hathaway did with it. I fully respect Eartha Kitt as Catwoman. We shall not speak of Halle Berry.
No.
But I'll tell you that Lee Merriweather, like, you know, like she's always. Maybe it's just because the age at which I first encountered her or something like that. But she's always going to be my first choice for Catwoman. Always. Mm-hmm.
So I am really interested because obviously the original Catwoman was Julie Newmar. Mm-hmm. So I take it you both like her more than Julie Newmar.
I really like Julie Newmar too, but yeah, I really like Lee Merriweather a lot. I think that she brings. Maybe it's just because Merriweather gets the opportunity to have sort of a fully fleshed arc outside of the Catwoman suit. That's a little more interesting and gives her a little more to do. So maybe there's an advantage there that she has in that she gets more to do that's more interesting and connects more on a human level than Newmar did.
Yeah, I have to say I'm more of a Merriweather fan because she just has that confidence about her in this role that I think you see throughout the whole movie, and that I like that she does get more to do with her, but also getting to show off that she's just a bit as good a villain, maybe even better villain than all the others, because she's always making fun of how dumb they are, even though she continues to work with them. Yeah, I think she embodies everything that I would expect from Catwoman as a character. So she's my favorite.
I do think she throws around the cat a little too nonchalantly, though. Like, as somebody who has had cats as pets, that cat in several scenes, especially on like the submarine or when they throw the cat on the raft or whatever, I could tell on the cat's face. It was like, what the hell is going on?
Right.
Somebody save me.
But I like how she plays up her own sort of characteristics of being cat-like, where it's like she's using a back scratcher.
Yep. Good point.
Or she's like licking her claws.
She's licking her own claws. Yeah.
So that was good. But yeah, out of the two, I like Meriwether a little better.
Well, I guess I'm really interested for both of you then as to where you'd come down ratings-wise with Batman the movie or just Batman.
Well, if we talk just Batman, that's a whole other podcast.
Well, sorry. And it the name of the movie is either Batman or it's also called Batman the movie
Let's call it Batman the movie, just sort of like that Star Trek 09 sort of thing, so that we know.
There you go. I like it.
So I would say out of five, I give this a 3 out of 5 Batcopters. Because I think that it still has a lot of things I enjoy and I will continue to rewatch. But the campiness, it's just not quite as much my thing. And that's kind of what I disliked some about the Roger Moore Bond films, too. So I take a little off for that and a little off for the unnecessary drawing out of some of the scenes. But otherwise, a solid 3.
I wind up, as much as I love it, it's a 3.5. It gets that extra little nudge simply because it fully embraces its insanity and just goes for broke. But it loses again. It is a little bit much. When I rewatch it, it tends to be in chunks, not start to finish. Where's my theme? I need my theme music, and it's conspicuously. Yeah. Not here, and that bothers me.
You mean the na-na-na-na-na-na doesn't work for you? You mean the na-na-na-na-na-na doesn't work for you?
Yeah. No. I need it. I need it as much as possible. I need that in my life. And but the thing is, you gave Batcopters, I'll give 3.5 cans of shark repellent.
There you go.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, because you use that other half of the can on the shark.
Yes.
Yeah, I think this probably lands at a 2.5 out of 5 for me. It's half a good movie, and part of that is just what we talked about. Like, I think that for me personally, it ruins a lot of the goodwill that it does have. Now, I'll say it went up 0.5 star my rewatch, partly because coming up with some things that I just was seeing that I was, was appreciating, but. It really does. It because it decides to draw out so much and go for way too long, it just hurts itself. Honestly, Adam West in the rewatch is really what makes this film. So I'm going to give this 2.5 out of 5 quick changes on a bat pole.
Oh, there you go. The costume change lever.
Yeah, exactly. You got to have that. So. Well, I always love this part of the show. I'm excited to see what we're going to recommend this week to everybody. So, Christy, what do you want to recommend to the listeners here at the 602 Club?
Well, as a huge Catwoman fan, this review actually reminded me of all of the Catwoman stuff I have around my house. And so I wanted to recommend something from that. So I don't know if everyone has heard of the artist Adam Hughes, but he's an incredible artist, at least in my opinion, who's done some really cool things as well with digital art. But he was inspired by the Darwyn Cook version of Catwoman and then tweaked it some and even kind of made her face somewhat like Audrey Hepburn's. So she's got a mix of a little bit of innocence, but still has that wild side to her as well. So I have a really great book of all of Adam Hughes' cover runs called Cover Run, the DC Comics Art of Adam Hughes, and it has Catwoman on the cover. But if you haven't seen that book, I highly recommend checking that out, or at the very least picking up some of his issues that he worked on and reading them, because they also had great writing. So that's what I'm recommending.
Very cool. Considering the fact that I don't think I'm allowed to recommend a beer because we're a family show, although I think Void Shaker by Funky Buddha is really, really good, I would go ahead and, you know, I'm actually going to recommend a book I'm actually reading right now. I'm in the midst of reading it, and it I can't think any more highly of it than I am in the moment. It's called The Pre-Astronauts, and it's the story, the real-life story of all of the experimental flights that were done with balloons leading up to the space program, and all of the breakthroughs that they made that helped the space program that they never got credit for, basically. And so it's fascinating because there are so many things where people look at the space program and say, oh, well, how did they figure this out? And how did they figure that out? It turns out this balloon program figured it all out for them. And the space program probably would have gone even better had they paid more attention to it. So again, it's called The Pre-Astronauts, and it's about human ballooning. They even went up. they basically went up into space in balloons, like they were skirting the edge of space. It's insane. Highly recommend it. Great book.
Nice. So I'm going to recommend something I got a chance to go to the movies this last weekend and see. I believe it's nominated for an Oscar, but it's called The Father, and it's got Olivia Colman and Anthony Hopkins in it. And it is an incredibly devastating movie. It just is utterly devastating in its portrayal of the descent into dementia. And what that must be like to experience and to then be on the other side of that experience, like a child trying to take care of a parent. It's a movie that I think it's important for everybody to see, just so that we have kind of familiarity, since so many of us will go through that one day with most likely our own parents. The performances are outstanding. And so I was moved, and it was an incredible film. It's a difficult film to watch, but it was worth the watch. And so if you've got a chance to see it wherever you are, recommend it. I think you could even rent it right now, or see it on like Apple TV, stuff like that. So. But yeah, it was just, I got a chance to see it. I know it had been nominated for, different awards, and this was a fantastic film. So probably, I'm sure, much better than my upcoming film this weekend, which is Mortal Kombat. So anyway, John, if anybody wants to catch up with you and see what else you've got going on when you're not in the 602 Club, where can they find you?
Well, gosh, I'd love to talk to everybody about the original Mortal Kombat movie that came out in the 90s, which I saw twice in the movie theaters because apparently I was suffering some sort of delusion. And there was nothing else.
Or dementia yourself.
Nothing else to do. I don't know. It was cheaper than a beer. What are you going to do? But you can find me as Kessel Junkie, KESSELJUNKIE. I encourage you to find me over on Letterboxd, where I have a lot of fun watching and rating movies like Batman the Movie. And you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network, co-hosting House Lights with Tristan Riddell, where we go through the works of directors from beginning to finish. And co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast, with one Matthew Rushing. What about you, Christy?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Bespin Bell. And then, when I'm not doing this show with Matt, I also do a show called Sabers and Spells, where I go through other geek-related topics that my friends and I don't usually get to cover, like Harry Potter and such. So we just finished our review of the first three episodes of Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and then made speculations. And now we're going to, after the last episode airs, do another review of the last half of the series. So hope everyone will come back and hear if our speculations are correct.
You can find me here on the network, of course, with 602 Club and Snyder Cuts, also doing The Orb as well as Literary Treks. The Orb is about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and Literary Treks about the books and the comics of Star Trek. All over social media, you can find me under the name Matt Rushing 02. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, when I'm not doing Aggressive Negotiations, we have one episode left, one of Outpost. I do that with Drea Kaufman, and we've talked through every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. So I hope you'll check that show up. It's pretty evergreen. It's perfect to listen to anytime. So, but thank you so much for joining us.
And y'all come back now, you hear? Mm-hmm.